Brian, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Brian.
I would thank Jerry, but he's not here, so I can skip that. That's nice. It's good to move on at that point. My sobriety date is July 20th of 2007. I'll do a mostly traditional story other than when I don't, you know. I did a lot of narcotics, but I'm going to try to limit my talk about that. I would like to give a shout-out, though. You don't get this every day. To Mike. Me and Mike used to party together back in the day, and this would be the first time he's heard my story in AA. And an interesting story about me and Mike. It's not a very good story. It's certainly not a funny story, but forgiveness in AA goes a long way to friendships. I tried to cut that kid's hands off with a meat cleaver about 15 years ago. That's funny to me. Clearly not to anyone else in here. I'm going to start with a little bit with what was going on with me today, just today, and ask you to do me a favor, and then we'll get kind of, you know, backtrack into the way it used to be, what happened, and what it's like now. So I woke up this morning. Do you hear that? I woke up this morning. I didn't come to. I woke up this morning, and I knew where I was. That's amazing to me. I woke up this morning, I knew where I was, and my wife was laying next to me. I didn't come to this morning searching for a bottle madly, sick from the night before, wondering who I was with. All these things are things for me to be grateful for. I woke up this morning, I knew where I was with my wife next to me in a house that we own, and heard my baby screaming from down the hall. And that to me is, that's enough. Like, I could stop right now and be done. My wife and I found out a couple years ago we couldn't have children. I thought it was probably her problem, but it wasn't. We ended up adopting. So we got into the adoption process last July, and then finalized the adoption in May, this first of this month. Stressful, crazy process. But we adopted out of Nevada, and the birth parents have my history. So when we were out there, we were able, got a chance to meet them and talk a little bit about sobriety, which was really cool. I didn't actually want to do that. I called my sponsor while I was out there and said, I can't believe they're going to make me do this. Like, I have the right to judge you for what you do. But all that to me is just baffling in comparison to where I was when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you could do me the favor, while I'm telling my story, remember those things. Remember those things that I just said. Because to me, that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't get a life back. I got a life when I got here. I didn't have one before. Nothing before. So I was born in 1971 in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, it was a terrible situation. Terrible, terrible situation. I had two loving parents that were upper middle class, well-educated, in a Christian home, and I had no needs or wants or desires that weren't filled. Horrible situation I grew up in. If you'd have asked me at age 13, it was their fault. Anything was their fault at that point. If you'd asked me at 25, it was their fault. If you'd asked me at 35, it was their fault that I had the problems that I had. I don't really remember my first drink, per se, or any of the other things that I like to enjoy when I was drinking. And I've heard a lot of people in meetings say, I felt alone, I felt out of place, I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. As a 44-year-old man, looking back, retrospectively speaking, yes, absolutely, I was full of anxiety and fear. If you'd have asked me at 13 what the problem was, I don't know. I just knew that there was a problem, a serious problem. For me, I had an overwhelming need to fit in. And I don't know where that comes from, other than potentially alcoholism. An overwhelming need to be accepted. And although now I see that I was accepted, right? I was invited to parties and church events and, little neighborhood things. And I had girlfriends. I mean, I was clearly accepted. But in my mind then, how I felt about what was going on, no one cared. And no one wanted me around. And they say in our literature that this is one of the problems I have is perception. You know, my perception when I was younger, when my parents said things like, hey, we love you, We want the best for you. What I heard was, we don't care about you, and you're worthless. And that kind of twisted thinking follows me until I find my way back into Alcoholics Anonymous. Unfortunately, I would like to tell you that kind of twisted thinking goes away when you stop drinking, but it does not. I clearly still have that kind of thinking. It just doesn't drive me like it used to. But when I look back on my history, when I was young, I was full of fear and anxiety and low self-esteem and all the things that, potentially lead me to the first drink. At age 13 or 14, I'm not sure when. If I got into my drug history, you would know why. I don't know when. But I drank. You know, somebody's brother, older brother, had Mad Dog, what is it, Boone's Farm or whatever, all that, the cheap stuff. And we drank in a field. And I don't know what happened to those guys. I have no idea what the experience was like for them. But I know for me, something happened that night that I connected with. I connected with apathy. Like, I had a word for how I felt now. I had a connection to something that would stay with me until I got sober. Something that I fed off of. And that was apathy. See, I can't tell you that the alcohol solved the problem of wanting to be accepted. It didn't. The alcohol mixed with the apathy made it so I didn't care. I don't care what you think about me now. Secretly, I cared, but I would never have told anybody that at the time. Alcohol gave me the promises that we talk about in AA. I had peace of mind and serenity for the first time probably in my life that I could remember. I felt good, So what I did as a kid was drink as often as I possibly could, as much as I possibly could. I've always been a more guy. I never was a social drinker. I never was a go-to-the-keg-party guy. I never was a let's go to your house and drink and do this, that, or the other as a 16-year-old kid. I mean, I drank alone. I drank alone. I drank before I went to school. I drank while I was in school. I drank on the way home from school. That's what I did. And I didn't see any problem with it. I mean, I was a better man for it. At 16, I found my way to my first AA meeting. I'm not a one white chip guy. I wish I was, but I'm not. And that's just based solely out of my rebellion. I don't remember anything. They had some couches, I think. I went back at 18 because I had my family had moved from West Texas back to the Southeast. We moved back to Alabama, and I wanted to follow in the footsteps of my parents. That their image of what was good, and so I went to college, went to the University of Alabama, and I wanted to do what they had done. And 2 months into my first college visit, I was getting suspended, not put on probation, suspended from the University of Alabama for a year, and there was talk of charges and all these other things, but all that got dropped, and they said, you have some options. We can either take you to rehab, or you can be without our money. And that is clearly an easy option to take. So I went to rehab. I went to rehab for 45 days. I got out of rehab, and I lived on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for 14 months to the day. Because at 18, I didn't have your problems. I couldn't relate to the stories I heard in those rooms at that time. I had never had a family to lose. I had never had a wife to lose. I'd never gone to jail. I'd never had a DUI. I couldn't seem to connect with what you talked about feeling, because clearly that would have been our connection at that point. I didn't see it that way. So I chased tail in AA and went to little sober dances and just had a blast until I met guys that were cooler than y'all, and they drank. And I was a kid. And so I spent more time with them and less time with you. And at 14 months, went to a bar where they clearly were going to serve me, and slid my one-year chip across the bar, and it gave me a drink. What I didn't realize at that time, and I don't think anyone could have helped me to realize at that time, was I had no idea what I was up against with alcoholism. No idea what that really looked like. So I drank, and then I spent the next, two or three years bouncing in and out of AA. You know, I used AA like some people use treatment centers, but you guys didn't cost any money. You know? I would drink, I would get in trouble, I would come here, you would give me coffee, you would tell me you cared about me, you would say, keep coming back, it made me feel good, I ate your donuts, I went to your house, I may have robbed you some pills, who knows? And then I drank, you know, and that was a cycle that I was in. And see, you guys talked to things about like God. Now, what I didn't do was read the literature that you said I should base my existence off of. I didn't do any of that. If I had, I would have noticed in the literature in We Agnostics that you actually told me your own conception of God. Or, you know, honestly ask yourself what these things mean to you. I didn't read anything. I didn't know that. I heard you talk about God, and what I heard was you talk about the religion of my youth. Now, again, twisted thinking, I had this perception of that that may have not been accurate. I didn't know that at the time. So you talked about God, and I left. And then I came back. And you talked about forgiveness, and I left. And then I came back, and that's what I did. And in 1993, I quit drinking. And I just cold turkey quit. What I did not quit, however, was all the other chemicals that I had been using with the alcohol. I was never a guy, and I'm sure I've met people like this in the rooms. I'm glad they're like this, but I was never like, I like uppers, I like downers, I like things that make me see things. I liked everything, and I liked a lot of it, and I liked it all the time. I found when I was in high school that if I sold some of these things, I could have some things for free. You know, I was actually spending any money. And then as I got older and I quit drinking, I met some guys that said, you know, you can sell a lot of this and make a living off of it. And I said, yes, that's a great idea. Let's do that. So I was following the Grateful Dead and selling all these things. You know, I think at the time I called myself a money exchanger and just had a blast. Irresponsible, immature, childish, selfish, but I was having a good time. In 1995, I met this beautiful young lady, 17-year-old runaway from Boston. I was 25, and I thought, this is what I need. I would probably be a better man if I married this girl when she turned 18, because I didn't want to go to jail. And she turned 18. I met her family one time. They were awfully impressed with me, you know. They said, man, what do you do for work? I don't have a job. Where do you live? I don't have a home. You know, what do you do? None of your business. I'm marrying your daughter when she turns 18. I mean, they were highly impressed with me. So we didn't really start off on necessarily a good foot in that marriage with her parents. But and most of the guys that I ran with, which were, what's the polite word, criminals, across the board said, this is a terrible idea. I mean, these are criminals that I work with. They're like, this is one of the worst ideas you've ever had. What are you doing? Like, I'm doing what I want, and I'm cutting you out of my life, and I'm cutting you out of my life, because you can't tell me what to do. So we married, and it was and I was in love, or lust, or, you know, because they were the same thing in my world at that time. So we'd been married for a year before she knew my real name. Didn't think it was important. I didn't see honesty in a marriage as important. I didn't see compassion in a marriage as important. I didn't see the whole like joint bank account thing, because I didn't have a bank account. I put my money in a farm somewhere else in a box, and you don't need to know about that. It's none of your business. And that's how we started. I mean, we started on solid footing in that marriage, I'm telling you. We stayed married for 7 years. In retrospect, she would have been good to have either gone to some Al-Anon meetings probably or just gotten the hell out as quickly as possible. Toward the end of the marriage, I found this out after I'd gotten into AA. My father and my best friend in California had told her, we will pay you to divorce him. We'll pay you to leave. Because they were afraid for her safety. Because when I, you know, I'm not sober. I'm really not a great guy. I'm pretty volatile. I'm pretty paranoid. I get my feelings hurt pretty easily. I'm pretty oversensitive, and, And if I got to swing at you, I will. And if I got to show up at your house with a gun, I will. Because I just couldn't stay grounded in reality. So that marriage ended pretty poorly, actually. And when it ended, and this is shocking to me now, but at the time when she separated me, I was crushed. I was like, I can't believe you're leaving me. I mean, I'm a great catch, man. Oh, my goodness. So delusional. I spent about 3 months living in an apartment somewhere, and I tried to come back here to y'all, and I almost was here, kind of. I mean, I didn't stop using narcotics, but I claimed that I was sober. And I kind of got a sponsor, but I didn't call because I was getting high. And I really wanted her back, you know? So I would call her and say, I'm doing great, baby. I'm sober. After I'd taken 15 Xanax, you know. So divorce papers came in the mail. And man, that was, I wasn't shockingly not prepared for that. Like, I thought somehow that it would not happen. It would be water under the bridge or something. She would take me back. And I did what any good alcoholic does. I put a loaded gun in my mouth and I pulled the trigger and I didn't hesitate. Very reactive at that time in my life. And I don't know why I didn't try again. I'm not sure about that. I do remember very vividly looking at the ceiling and screaming, it's on. You cursed me to live. This is where we're going to play it. It's on. And the next several years of my using was really bad. I felt as if God had cursed me to live. And we were now in a game for my life. And that's the way we're going to continue moving forward. I did another thing that day, and you people in AA had warned me that this might happen. But I knew more than you, so I didn't listen. You said that if you stop drinking and then go back to it, it's a progressive illness. It will be like you never stopped drinking. So I hadn't taken a drink in 10 years. And I put that gun on the table in tears, and I walked to the liquor store. And I got a bottle of Maker's Mark, and I went outside the building, and I pulled that little red waxy stuff off the top of that bottle, and I drank that whole bottle. And I hadn't had a drink in 10 years. And I went back inside, and I bought two more, and I walked home. And about 10 days later, when I came out of that, like, bender, I realized briefly, like a moment of clarity, I realized, oh, my God, they're right. It was like I had never quit drinking. Like, almost instantly, I progressed 10 years. So everything from that point on was, for me, I drank and used the things I did to die. And I made a pretty conscious decision daily that because I didn't have a job and I was living off money that I'd made illegally, that I would do everything in my power to use enough to die. And boy, I gave it my all. You know, I really did. I did a lot of geographic relocating during that period of time. Right? And I mean a lot of moving. Because, you know, the Southeast was clearly a problem. And Colorado was clearly a problem. And California was a problem. And Indiana was a problem. And it was a litany of places that I lived. What also became a problem was people. People became a problem. You know, people that I knew real well and had known for a long time, if I came to stay with you, pretty quickly you were getting me out of your house. And I was not allowed back there. And I was saying things and doing things that, I mean, hell, man, I had regrets while I was drinking, you know. I mean, I couldn't believe the kind of person I had become. And I just couldn't stop, no matter what. In 2005, I was... I guess in St. Louis, from what they say, and I was doing a B&E job, and I was climbing over this fence that was about 25 foot high. It was like 7 in the morning, so it was daylight, which seems insane to me now that I'd be doing a B&E job in broad daylight, but I was. And when I woke up coming out of ICU, I was like, what happened? And this girl that was there said, they say that your foot clipped the top bar coming over the top and you did like a Greg Louganis dive into some concrete. and it was shattering all the bones in my hands, both my wrists, broke all the bones in my forearms, and had a 7.5-inch skull fracture, almost died. And you know, I look back at that now and I think, well, that probably was a pretty clear wake-up call. But it wasn't at the time for me. 4 days after I came out of ICU, the doctors and nurses had a come-to-Jesus talk with me after they caught me drinking vodka in the bathroom. You know, I had cast on from knuckles to shoulders, but I needed a drink, so I got into that bathroom, with my little wheelie thing, and started drinking with this really long straw they give you. And I was pretty lit up when those doctors came in, and they were pretty unhappy about that. I didn't know there was a rule against drinking in the hospital like that, I guess. But they were pretty clear with me about what would happen if I did that again. So I did that again the next day. But I didn't drink in my room. I made my way down the hall to someone else's room and barricaded the door and drank in their room. And I was screaming and cussing when they were wheeling me outside of that hospital because I didn't have anywhere to go. The guys that I'd been working with that owed me money put me in this trap crack hotel somewhere and said, we're going to send somebody here once a week to pick you up and get you groceries and liquor. Good luck. And at one point, this delivery driver, who I don't know how I came in contact with him, but he said, I'm going to stop by once a week and just make sure you're alive. I was like, why? What's wrong with you? I lost 55 pounds in 10 weeks. All I did was drink. My hands were crushed. I couldn't wipe my own butt. I couldn't wipe my nose. I couldn't sleep laying down. And I became psychotic while I was there. Again, pretty clear picture that there's something going on there. You know, maybe you might want to peer into the drinking or the drug use, but I didn't do that. I didn't do that at all. I had my friend in California called my parents and said, he's going to die. Either we can pick him up or you can. So I hadn't seen my dad in 2 or 3 years at that point, and a knock on the door came, and I opened the door, and it was him. And he was in tears. He just couldn't believe what had happened to his son. I was 35 years old at that time. I weighed maybe, you know, 120, maybe, and strung out and drunk and not doing well emotionally or mentally at that time. I had started having these people that weren't actually there that I was having conversations with all day. It was a good time over in that hotel. I came back to Atlanta. Dad drove me back here, and I hope I never ever forget this next thing ever in my life. My mom was real pre-Al-Anon-y back then, and I had convinced myself that if I drank light beer, if I drank under 36 light beers a day, I wasn't an alcoholic, because that was like drinking water and alcohol. I was getting both of those at the same time. So I did that. I drank 36 beers a day and felt like I was doing great. I mean, that, you know, I'm like healthy now, you know. I wasn't doing drugs like I had been before, and things were just going really well, I thought. They got me into some physical therapy, and my mom was feeding me a lot, you know, a lot. Like, it seemed like a lot to me anyways. And I asked her, I said, "What? Why are you doing this? What's wrong with you?" And I hope I never forget this. She looked dead in my eyes, man, and tears welled up in her face, and she said, "Son, we're trying to fatten you up for your next run." And she walked away. Because they knew. They knew the kind of man I'd become. 2006, I made my way back to Atlanta after another long binge of drinking. And by the time I'd made it back, they had a restraining order out against me, because they'd learned over time that if it wasn't nailed down and they let me in the house, it was gone. And it didn't matter what it was. And I tried. I tried desperately, man. I came back to you people because, I mean, I could see the end coming. It was getting pretty clear. And I came here, and you said you got to be honest, open-minded, and willing. And I said, no, that's not what I have to do. I'll give you my name, and that's all I'm going to give you. And I worked some steps, and I didn't understand why they weren't working. Why is this stuff not working for me? And now, mind you, I've been honest about nothing other than my name So all the step work is a farce, man, at that point. And it didn't take too long for me for the ego to start to rebuild itself. And I was doing this thing where, and I met a lot of guys that did this. I would drink from about 5 a.m. to 3 in the afternoon and sober up and come to these meetings. Because God knows I didn't want you to know I was an alcoholic. I mean, hell, if you knew I was drinking all day, you might think I had a drinking problem. And I would come to these meetings to raise my hand and share this great stuff because I'd been in and out of AA a long time. I knew what to say. And I would go to 2 meetings a day and I would leave there and I would go drink. And I would drink all night. And I would pass out and I would wake up and I would start drinking. I did that for about 3 weeks every day. And then I got this idea that, you know, if I just go out to California, these people that I know, they'll teach me how to be a functional alcoholic. And that was my goal. That was the only goal I had left in life. I just want to learn how to be a functional alcoholic. I mean, I don't want to quit. I just want to function. And I don't want to do drugs anymore. That was the plan. And I met with the guy that is still my sponsor now and told him that. And he said, okay. And I said, you know what I'll do? I'll keep your number. So that when I figure out how to be a functional alcoholic, I'll call back here and you can stop going to those classes. And he said, okay, good luck to you. And I was gone. The next day I took a one-way flight to California. The guys out there thought I was on vacation, so I assume they thought it was a round-trip flight, but it was not. They only asked me to do one thing, which wasn't drink, and I was so drunk when I got off the plane, they had to kind of pour me into the car. I spent about 2 weeks out there before they let me go. Couldn't handle it, man. They had kids and jobs, and they could not handle me. And that was the beginning of the end for me. By July of 2007, I was homeless again, living in St. Louis under a bridge, and I'd become convinced that God wasn't going to let me die, and I was going to be 65 years old, living on the streets, doing what broke homeless men do on the streets to get drunk, which was pretty degrading stuff. And so I called that number. Well, that guy was going to show how to become a functional alcoholic and ask him, what do I do? And that was the end of AA. If he hadn't answered the phone, I'd have died. I'm pretty positive about that. I said, what am I supposed to do? He said, well, if you come back here, maybe you'll get better. And then I said, what a good alcoholic says. Can you send me money for a bus ticket? And I heard, he was done with the conversation. It took me about 3 weeks to make it to the bus station. Man, there's a lot of drugs in between where I was and the bus station. And I did what I had to do to get a ticket. And I got back here, and I showed up back here as terrified as I've ever been in my life. Because I knew that this stuff worked. I had family members that came here, it worked for them. I knew some of you people from back in the day, it worked for you. But God, man, I was convinced it wasn't going to work for me, that I had blown my shot. I got off the bus, and he took me to a convention of, like, what seemed to be thousands and thousands of people, you know. Took me to the Atlanta Roundup in 2007, and I heard a lady named Polly Pistol talk, and talked about beating her kids when she was drinking, and I got through the night because I could relate to that swinging of the hands. The next night, a guy named Clancy spoke. I sat on the front row, not because I wanted to, but because that's where my sponsor had me sit. And I wore a baseball cap, and he called me out for wearing a baseball cap. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to get kicked out of AA when I beat this old man's ass. But, excuse my language. I made it through the meeting, and I made it through the next day, and I didn't understand at the time how blessed I was to see those guys, to hear those speakers. I had no idea how blessed I was. All I could think about was committing suicide. That's all I thought about anymore. My sponsor asked me, you know, hey, if you can do just a part of what I asked you to do. I mean, I'd ask you to do it all, but that's not going to happen. I know you pretty well. You can do just a part of what I asked you to do. You might have a shot at this. And then he said something that I'm very happy about at that time for me. He said, you can call these suggestions, but these are clear-cut directions. If you can't follow them, find another guy to work with you. And I said, okay. I was terrified, man. And because it was the only guy I knew anymore that would like accept a phone call from me. You know, I was calling him like 15 times a day, man. I didn't know what to do. And we started doing step work pretty immediate, almost immediately. Step one for me this time around was kind of easy. It wasn't that hard. I mean, I didn't have any plans left, man. I was out of ideas. My ego, it took so long for my ego to rebuild itself this time that I actually had a legitimate shot at grace coming in. I was blessed, man, real blessed. I go through this thing every Christmas where I sit in meetings and I look around the meetings to the guys and I see chairs that are empty and I think about the guys that were sitting there with me a couple years ago that are dead now. And I cry, man. It just overwhelms me. They didn't do anything different than I did. I mean, I get the gift and they don't. I don't understand how that happens. But I'm glad I got it. We got to the second, third step, and then I started having problems pretty quickly. He said, Brian, I want you to go home and get on your knees tonight and thank God for keeping you sober. And I thought, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard anyone say ever. And I walked away, you know, like we do. We do this. A lot of us do this. I will never confront you with my anger, but I'll grumble under my breath about you as I leave your presence. You know? And I grumbled all the way home. And then I got on my knees because, you know, I didn't want to lose him as a sponsor, and I didn't want to die drunk. I called him up the next morning and I said, Jason, I'm going to let you know, man, I cussed your God last night. And he didn't respond the way I thought he would. He said, that's great. That's good news. That's an open line of communication, man. You didn't have that before. We're going to go with that. Every night for the next 2 months, every morning for the next 2 months, I want you on your knees cussing my God. I think my God can handle it. Okay. You know? I mean, that's my out, you know, and it's gone. So that's what I did. And since then, I've seen enough in AA to grow into some kind of new relationship, you know. I've seen enough to be amazed that there's something. I don't need to know what it is, but there's something out there that keeps people like me so, keeps us on the level. We did a four step. He gave me 7 days. I got it done in an afternoon because, well, I was unemployable. I hung out in AA meetings all day. I was terrified and angry and bitter and jealous and not employable at that time. You know? So it was pretty quick to get that done. And we got up and we met up, and I've heard people in AA say, man, I felt all this freedom when I did a fifth step. And I think, lucky you, I didn't have that. I was more suicidal at the end of that than I'd ever been. All I wanted to do was die. Why? Well, you know, you guys gave me a clear picture, a real clear picture at me, that all those resentments were on me, and all that fear was on me, and all that sexual misconduct was on me. It didn't have anything to do with them. It wasn't their fault. I couldn't blame them anymore, and that was on me, and I had to take responsibility for my own actions, and I was not exactly prepared to do that. I'm not sure I knew how to do that. And AA did for me during that time what it does for lots of us. It carried me on its shoulders until I was able to make it down the road a little bit, you know. 6 and 7 were confusing at best. He said, are you willing to yada, 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 yada? Okay, yeah, whatever. We're going to eat soon, you know. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. I've grown over time. A little bit anyways. My fourth and fifth steps now are mostly fear-based. I do a fourth and fifth step every spring, like spring cleaning, because I don't do a 10th step on a regular basis, so clearly I'm going to resent somebody at the end of the year. But most of my stuff is fear-based now. 6 and 7 keep me in the game now. I didn't even understand them when I first did them. But now it's clear to me that my perception is twisted. That I'm defensive. I get my feelings hurt very quickly. I'm oversensitive. I'm paranoid. I'm delusional. And my head and my heart are connected. And I'm still an alcoholic and a junkie, so I base what I do as far as reactions on how I think it's going to make me feel. which is usually not based in reality at all. So I got a much clearer picture of what we're working with over here and the reason that my defects flare like they do at times. And I'm glad that I have a solution and or a way out of having those drive me back to a drink. Eight-step list was pretty easy because I'd done a pretty thorough four-step. Ninth-step was interesting. It didn't go as well as I had hoped. Now, mind you, my perception is twisted. I'm still here, and I didn't drink, so it went better than it should have. But, you know, I had some people in my life that weren't like, oh, yeah, that's great. You're doing great, you know. I didn't have a lot of that go on. I drove to Nashville to make amends to my sister. I showed up, and she met me outside of her front door. The door shut behind her. That was probably a bad sign. And she said, I don't care. Well, you know, I'm here to, but I don't care. You ever get 5 years sober, come back and see me. Until then, don't talk to me. Walk back inside and shut the door. I drove home in tears from Nashville, you know. And now we have a relationship. See, a lot of these people in my life, they wanted to see something different. They didn't want to hear anything anymore from me. They wanted to see something different. I made an amends to that ex-wife, and I hadn't talked to her in 5 years at that point. And my sponsor first asked me, what do you want this to look like? And I said, well, you know, I mean, it'd be great if we could go out to dinner, you know, and maybe, you know, good, have a good conversation, and maybe do a little dessert or coffee, and then, you know, get a hotel room and get back together. And he said, that's fantastic. Let's revisit this. We would put it off for several months and revisit it. And I finally hit a point in my recovery there in the first year where I became clear to me that the best amends I could make to that girl was to leave her the hell alone. That she had enough of me. And so I found an address through some friends and I sent a letter. And I would like to tell you that I sent the letter and I wasn't attached to the outcome, but that would be a complete lie. But I became less attached as I never got a response, you know. One night I got a call from her, and we had talked about 5.5 years, I guess. And this is something that changed the way that I view my time in AA. Changed the way that I view a lot of things in AA. She said, I forgive you. I have a question. Do you forgive me? Why would I need to forgive you? She said, we took vows in sickness and in health. You were sick and I left you. And things changed for me at that moment. See, I didn't realize what you guys did in here exactly. I mean, I thought this was about quitting drinking and doing other things that I did and maybe not lying as much and maybe being open to some relationship with something outside of me. I mean, I got all that. I didn't understand this was about freedom. This, for me, is about freedom. I ask myself on a pretty regular basis and ask my guys that I work with, how free do you want to be? This for me is about having that stuff that I chased for so long, the freedom that I have inside. And how do I get that freedom? Well, I get that freedom by forgiving y'all and being tolerant of you and not judging you and being compassionate and being loving and all the things that my God wanted me to be off the rip that I never knew about and I never knew how to do. And in that short conversation, I learned a whole lot about if I want to stay here with y'all, that I'm going to have to do things differently. You know, like I said, the 10th step, I'd like to say I work on a regular basis, but I don't. So, you know, I get to do a 4-step inventory every year because of that. The 11th step, I didn't really understand. I probably understand it more now than I used to. It means more to me now than it used to. And the 12th step, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to work with you. I mean, I had all these notions of how that would go, and I didn't want to do that. And my sponsor made it clear to me, and clear in a way that I can understand. He's always been very good to break things down in a way that I can understand, which is good. He said, were you Pablo Escobar, man? Were you running a cartel out there? I said, well, no. No, I wasn't doing that. He said, so you were a middleman, right? You were like a corner kid. You worked off the middle. And I said, yeah, okay, yeah, I was a middleman, I'll give you that. He said, that's what we do here. You're a middleman, man. This is the job that you know. This is the role you've always played. See, what we have is we have a book, and in that book they can contact God. And there's a guy over here, you know, and all you're doing is sharing your experience out of this book with him. That's it. That's all you're doing. And I thought, oh, okay, I might can do that. He said, let me ask you another question. If you sold something to somebody, did you follow them home and see how they used it? No. He said, great, great. That's what we want you to do. Give the information and let them have their own experience. And I said, man, that makes a lot of sense, man. I can do that. So I got some sponsees, and I've kept them. I've kept sponsees since I've been here. Not all of the guys I got originally have stayed sober, but boy, I did. You know, the thing is, this is just for me. I'm still an alcoholic, and I'm still a junkie. And, man, I like to catch the buzz. I like the feeling I get. I work with a new guy, and the light comes on. I catch a buzz off of that. I get an opportunity to be a part of your recovery by speaking. I catch a buzz off of that. So, you know, I'd like to say that most of what I do is based out of great compassion I have for y'all, but it's not. It's because I feel better doing it. Maybe one day that'll change for me, but it hasn't yet. In the time I've been sober, I've been blessed. I've been real blessed. I've had some really good things happen. I've had some not great things happen. Like I said, I have a wife, so clearly I actually got married, which is shocking to me that anyone would remarry me. You know what that's like, don't you? I had some bad things happen around that marriage, though. You know, my wife's father was one of us, and he couldn't get in here, and he made the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. Our literature talks about that. And her mother was emotionally not well at times after that. And she struggled. She wasn't one of us, but she really struggled. And we had some anger with her, man, before we got married, because she wasn't showing up for things. I was talking to my sponsor about it, and I was back and forth. I was trying to be compassionate. And we went by 3 days before our wedding to check on her, because she wasn't going to make it to the wedding, and she'd been dead for 8 days. She committed suicide. And I felt anger that I had not felt in a long time. I felt rage that I had not felt in a long time. And I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't do the things that AA had asked me to do. I didn't show up to meetings. I didn't share about it. I didn't talk to people about it. I hid away with that pain, and it started to eat me alive at that point. That happened on June the 13th of 2012. We married June the 16th. I picked up a 5-year medallion July 20th of that summer. August 20th, I was headed to the liquor store. I could not deal with the pain in my chest. And I didn't drink that day, and I called some of the older guys that I had been burglarizing conversations from this whole time, you know, that I've been sober, and actually approached any of those guys. And I called a guy named Bill and a guy named Bob and a guy named Paul, and I said, what am I supposed to do here? I'm going to die. I'm going to die in AA. In AA, I'm going to die behind this. And they said, well, you know, there's some work you can do. So I started meeting this older gentleman once a week and doing grief work and doing work on my anger. And I've been very fortunate. I got to a point, and I'm not totally there every day now, but I got to a point where I could forgive her. Because if I can't stay here, right? I mean, this is about freedom, and if I get freedom out of forgiveness and I can't forgive you for what you've done, I can't stay here. Now, maybe you can, but I know I can't. I will drink again behind that. And that's been an interesting thing in our life, man. I've learned how to be a listener. I didn't know how to do that before. I mean, I'm almost 5 years sober. I had sponsees, and I didn't know how to listen to anybody. I didn't realize that. And I got a chance to learn how to do that with my wife when she was going through the suicide of her mother. I didn't know that was possible. And I didn't know that was powerful. Since then, we bought some property and, you know, kind of settled in. And decided to adopt, and our baby's named after her mom, you know. So we get that full circle thing on a pretty regular basis in our household. Overall, I'm extremely grateful. I'm extremely grateful for what I have. And I asked you to do something earlier, right, to remember the things I talked about earlier. That, to me, is the power of AA in God, man. That's the power of AA. A guy like me who didn't care at all about you or myself, clearly, when I drank, gets to be a father and a husband and a member of a, man, something that is so much larger than me. I get to be connected to a God when I come here, right? Whether I talk or listen, I get to get connected to something much larger than me. And I get a lot of the promises that I thought that alcohol would give me. It's interesting to me, I hear guys in AA, I certainly have said this before, it's about doing the work, man. It's about doing the work. I got to tell you, in comparison to the work I did to drink every day, this does not feel like work to me. This is a lot less work-oriented than that was. It's uncomfortable at times. It's uncomfortable to grow up at times. It's an uncomfortable thing when I look in the mirror and I think, man, I'm 44 and I act like a child. What's wrong with me? And it's interesting because sometimes I have to go to my wife when I'm apologizing and say, I'm sorry that you have a baby to raise and a baby that you're married to. But that's how I act sometimes. I've been given the gift, man. I've been given some clarity. I've been given the ability to be a part of the world. I've been given the ability to connect with something way more powerful than me, and that's love. And I did not have the ability to do that before I got here. So in ending, I owe everything to y'all. Everything that I have, I owe to you. So I appreciate that very much. There have been times in my sobriety where I'm able to walk on my own 2 feet, and you can find God on the soles of my shoes. And then there's times in my path here with y'all where I've had to stay on your shoulders. But I'll do you the favor of letting you know that if you need the same in return, get my number. Thank you.